I hear myself. Okay, so Daniel asked me to give a lecture on quantum error correction and experiment. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to close the door. And what maybe I can start by what I will not do, which will be a complete overview of what anybody in the world has done on error correction and experiments. What I'll do instead is show some of the experiments that we've been doing here in Waterloo and have done in the past on implementing ideas of error correction in one specific device, NMR, like error magnetic fluorescence. So a good part of the course today will be putting you up to date on NMR, how it works and all this, and see how it is implemented. I'll try to pick up some small pieces in there that can be useful for the rest of the course. One of them is error propagation, or looking at circuits. And also, once you implement this, what are the criteria? What are the interesting things to look at? And why were we interested in this? So I want to come back to one thing. And first ask you, have you heard of the accuracy threshold theorem? So Daniel started this course with this and say, this is the basic thing, but you haven't heard it in Daniel's course. So there it is. It's probably his conclusion. But for me, it's the beginning. So there is this theorem on quantum error correction called the accuracy threshold theorem, which says that if a quantum computation can be as long as required with any desired accuracy, so give me the length of your quantum computation, got many gates. Give me the accuracy of the result that you want to have at the end. And if the noise level is below a threshold value, then the fact that there is noise is not an impediment to arrive at this accuracy with a number of gates which will be polynomial on the original size of the problem and polynomial on 1/1 the accuracy that you have. Which means that implementing error correction or computing even in the presence of errors does not change a problem which would be polynomial in a problem which would be exponential. And why do I bring this in? It's because if you don't do error correction, if you have errors, if you have probability of success for each gate, which will be 1 minus delta, if you put that in gates, and the probability of success would go down exponentially. And error correction tells you that it can transform this exponential decay into something which is constant. With an amount of resources, and this is really important, that I think most of you are physicists, and physicists usually don't think about the amount of resources that you need. And here, it's incredibly important. The amount of resources they are using to fight the error is polynomial. And it's polynomial as long as you are below a threshold. Here, I put the threshold of 10 minus 4, but you see 10 minus 4 because I was not good enough with Adobe Photoshop to make it very fuzzy. Because we don't really know what the threshold is. And I should be a little bit more careful on this.
How's that different than Shannon's?
I think it is very similar to Shannon's there. So it's a quantum version. Yeah. So it's very fuzzy because the value of the threshold depends on what is the type of noise you have, exactly what kind of code that you're using, how do you implement these gates, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in all these values of thresholds, there is an assumption of what the noise model is. There's always an error model that you can think of where you'll never be able to do error correction. If you're the devil, and your devil is not on your side. And you can always go and flip bits at the last moment before you even read it. So there's always an error model where you cannot do error correction. But there are error models which are reasonable. When you use your CD player, for example, and you go on your mountain bike, you can still listen to it and it doesn't come up. As long as you don't hit the rocks too hard, you're still be able to listen to the music. The reason is that very, very good error correction, the error model is not too bad. In fact, if you even take your CD, if you make an error model where you scratch your CD, if you scratch it really early, no problem, you can listen to it and you'll never hear that there's a crack or scratch. But if you make the scratch circular, then the error correction is not very good. So there, the error model is very important on that kind of thing. And typically, if you take your CD and you throw them around, the scratch will be kind of in the diameter direction and not kind of circular. So that works very well there. In quantum system, we don't really understand what is the real error model. And the motivation for me of implementing or going to work in NMR was exactly this, to understand what is the error model in these systems. And are they ones which would be amenable to error correction? Well, after about 10 years of doing this, the answer that I have on this is that it's approximately correct. It's not really a reasonable, tameable noise model, but still not sure. So that's why I got interested in this and went to other things. The significance of this theorem is that we imperfection and precisions of a device that we want to build are not fundamental objection to quantum computing. Again, if we don't do error correction, any kind of imprecision, imperfection which accumulate can make our results which would be unreliable as we scale up to larger and larger computations. But error correction tells us that it is not the case for specific error model with a certain set of assumptions. The interesting thing for me is also it gives us a criteria for scalability. If you go and talk to a typical experiment list and you say, oh, you're building a quantum information processing device, is it scalable? Typically, the physicists will look and say, well, it's scalable because if I have a qubit there, I can add a second one, a third one, a fourth one, sixth one. And this, therefore, my device is scalable. Well, for computer scientists, it's slightly different. I think this gives a very well-defined definition. It gives a definition of what I mean by scalability. That in these accuracy threshold theorem, there's a set of assumptions. You look at your device, and are they fulfilled these assumptions? And if they are, it means that if there is noise in your system, you can still go up and do computations which are reliable with that amount of resources, which are available. So maybe I should say that it gives probably necessary condition for scalability. I'm not really sure if they are always sufficient. There might be some other thing there, but definitely necessary. Its requirements are a guide for experiment lists, because at least in the device that we have for quantum information processing today, the noise level is relatively high. So we won't be able to do very large quantum computation without error correction. So there we will need to have kind of be guided so that we are able to implement quantum error correction. There's many assumptions in the accuracy threshold theorem, and many of them can be exchanged from one to the other, like the type of noise. If the noise is a little bit more nasty, you can quite often solve this by using different types of code. But there's one of them which I don't know if there's a way around, which is you need to be able to do parallel operation. If you have a quantum information processing devices which cannot do parallel operation, then nobody has an idea how to be easy to provide. So here's one example of a guide for experiment. Another one is precision of all these kind of gates that we need to do to get to this threshold.
In which fundamental way your parallel gates actually come up in those things?
So why do we need this?
Yeah.
Because as you have more and more qubit, suppose that you don't want to do computation. You just want to do keep something in memory. So that would be easy. So as you have more and more qubits, and the error rate is always the same, delta. You have more and more qubits. Mm-hmm. The error rate is going to go like n times delta. And that's some way in the approach. So you'll have to do things kind of in parallel. So the effective error rate per qubit doesn't go up. Finally, I would say it's a benchmark to compare different technologies. Like right now, we have a bunch of different technologies which do quantum information processing, IMTrap, superconducting conducting qubits, NMR, optics, and everything. And people will go and say, my device is better than yours because I can do I can do 10,000 one qubit gate. If you really go and look at this, you can say, well, you're not able to do 1-2 qubit gates, so it's not very useful. Other devices are very good at doing 2 qubit gates, but they can do parallel operation. So really, when we try to evaluate how good our device, implementing error correction and say, how long can you keep some quantum information with so many qubits would be a very good example of benchmark, compare one thing to the other. So that's what brought me to investigate the idea of error correction in the physical device. Now that I've thought about theory, I should kind of think about experiment and warn you that the experimental stage of quantum information processing is, and the amount of information processing that we can do is very, very much behind where the theory is. Like manipulating a few qubits is the state of the art. So when you do think about the accuracy threshold theorem, you're thinking about thousands of qubits and kind of all putting together and manipulating them. When we go in the lab, if you think about doing things fault tolerant with kind of very large code that might be code, then no, it's out of the way. So the only thing you can do is very small information processing, but at least it's the first step in trying to translate these ideas of quantum information processing to the lab or quantum error correction to the lab. So what I want to do is go down and talk about one particular implementation in MR and why that one is because I've been working on that one, it's the one I know the most, but that's the one which has implemented error correction for the first one. So I'm going to tell you now how to go and implement one code, and the code that I'll be interested in is the one to correct for fake. So you'll see in a second why I'm interested in this. So the first thing that we're looking at when we have a device is what are the qubits. So here the qubits are the pure space. If you look at different atoms, some atoms like hydrogen, carbon 13, have a magnetic moment, which is described by a spin half particle, so they are the ideal qubit that we're thinking of. And then we can use them, and naively, if they point up, it's the zero, they point down, it's the one, we can put them in superposition, and we can kind of make them interact, and that's what we're going to try to do. So they are very tiny little magnets. And to set them up on the initial state, what we do is that we put them in a very large magnet, which are made of superconducting material. And the strength of the magnet is about 10 tesla. So if we take the hydrogen atoms to the 10 tesla magnet, we may put them perpendicular to this magnet, for example, that you remember from your high school. If you have a very strong field in the new direction, small magnet in the right direction, there's a torque which is induced in the third direction, makes them rotate at a frequency called the Larmor frequency. So you take the hydrogen atom, you put it in a 10 tesla magnet, and what you get is a frequency which is of the order of 500 megahertz. So it takes about a nanosecond for this spin to go around. So that's sort of one piece of information we're going to do. If we have a molecule which has more than two atoms, like this, or maybe I should say it here, that would work. The magnetic moment of the hydrogen, the magnetic moment of the carbon are different. So then they have a different Larmor frequency, and that's how we're going to identify the different qubits. Instead of talking to the qubits in real space, we're going to talk to them in frequency space, the frequency that they are, that they have in that big magnet that we put them in. If we have a third atom, second carbon, for example, then you might say, then these two carbon will have the same magnetic moment. Like if you take two carbon atoms in free space, they have the same magnetic moment, so how are we going to distinguish them? It turns out that we'll look at the molecule which is not symmetric between the two carbons, and the electronic cloud is going to shade one slightly differently than the other one, so that'll be an effective magnetic moment which comes in because the electrons are kind of changing the effective external magnetic field or the effective magnetic moment. And we're going to use this. So it'll be a difference of Larmor frequency between two carbons, which is called a chemical shift. And so we'll be able to talk to one carbon without talking to the other. So we take this, we put this in this, we take many copies of them, of this molecule, put this in a solvent, put this little sample, which looks like this. Okay, so this is the sample, and we're going to put this in the magnet, which is down here. So the size of the sample is about this. The reason why we don't have a single molecule is that when we try to observe this, we do it in the following way. if the spin is indeed perpendicular to the field, and if we put a little coil like this around the sample, you will remember from your basic electromagnetism that if you have a magnetic moment rotating around a coil, it induces a current. You go and measure the current, you do the Fourier transform of this current, and you get some peaks at some frequency, although not frequency. So that's how we're going to measure the spin at the end. But the current for one spin is extremely small. So we don't have detectors which are large enough. What we do is we put about 10 to the 15 spins in the sample, and then we measure the average of all of them. So it is slightly different than the usual model of computation where we measure qubit by a projective measurement. Here we make an ensemble measurement. The molecules from them, which have the qubits in them, are tunneling very fast again with respect to each other. And so you might have expected the interaction between the molecule with different qubits, but it turns out because they are tunneling very, very fast, then there's effectively no interaction. And you can detect this. So the molecules don't talk to each other. So the only reason why we need many molecules is only because when we measure them, measurement is very, very weak for each spin, but they add up with each other. So we know how to measure them. We know what the qubits are. So now, how do we manipulate them? So if we take the same coil that we've used for the measurement, instead of reading a current on it, we send a current at the radio frequency, which is at the Larmor frequency for one of the spins. Then what happens is that if you go in the rotating frame of that nuclear spin, it looks like a constant magnetic field. And if this constant magnetic field is set up so that it's the light, let's say that the z direction is perpendicular, it's vertical, let's say we are in the x direction, then it's going to induce a torque on the spin which is there in the rotating frame. Field is in this direction, it imposes something in that direction, so the spin is going to move. So by sending a pulse in that coil, we can make one qubit move around. So here's a picture there. Let's assume we started up, and it turns out that the equilibrium did all the spins of point up. We send a magnetic field, which is in this direction here, okay, in the rotating frame now, so it looks like a constant. It does rotate by a certain angle. Let's say, rotate that direction. So by either changing the strength of that magnetic field, the power of the radio frequency field, or the time at which we act, then we can rotate by some certain angles. So we can, there's problems of exactly how do we calibrate this, but I'm not going to talk about this. You can go and calibrate this. So you can, if you tell me I want to have 17 degree, then you can just go and make a 17 degree. If you want around the axis X or Y, then you can do it. It turns out that how do we distinguish just X and Y? It's the phase of this magnetic field. It tells us where we are in the XY plane. Okay? So with this, we have one qubit gate. And you remember, I hope, from your quantum information processing course, that if you have one bit gate and two bit gates, they have a universal set of gates. So if you can talk to them one by one, and so forth, I'll back up a bit. First, maybe I should tell you that we have a universal set of one qubit gate. We can do any one. If you can do an X gate by any angle, a Y gate by any angle, you can also do a Z gate by combining X and Y. So if you do Y and X minus Y, this will induce a Z rotation. Okay? So I assume that everybody understands this. So with this, you can go and kind of make any gate. Turns out when we do the experiments, I mentioned to you that you can do a 17 degree gate if you want. But when we calibrate, it's a lot easier to calibrate 90 degrees and 180 degrees. But what we have very, very precise is the angle in the XY plane. And really the set of gates that we've been using in the experiments I've mentioned to you is a 90 degree or 180 degrees around any axis around X or Y. And this turns out to be a universal set of gates. So you don't need to do rotation around some funny angle of this by 13 degrees. Just rough angle around X, Y is sufficient. In fact, it's even simpler than this. you remember that we're rotating around the z-axis all the time? So we have this rotating frame. And every time I've been talking to you and assuming I'm in the rotating frame, you can redefine your rotating frame at any time, right? We started by saying, let's say, x is in that direction. As you evolve, if you do an x rotation, you can say you're rotating in that rotating frame from there to there. Or you remain your qubit there, but you change what you mean by your rotating frame by 90 degrees. You can do both. If you add that vertical gate to a rotation around 90 degrees around one axis, this is universal. So this is pretty neat, because you have only one gate to do. You send the pulse to a 90 degree. And then the rest, you're just redefining your rotating frame while you do things. The spins are rotating around. You just send your pulse from time to time, 90 degree, and that's what we're doing. The advantage of this is that these virtual gates are error-free. And when we first kind of thought about this many years ago, many Neil and I, we thought we were cheating. Well, it turns out that it's not cheating. You can do it. And we use this to do some kind of compiler and kind of redefine our pulse sequence kind of in terms of z rotation and only rotation about one angle on the xy plane. So we use this. So I hope by now you're convinced that we have a universal set of one qubit gate. The next thing is to have two qubit gates. So if you think about when I showed you the larger frequency, I told you magnetic field in that direction, spin in that direction, torque in that direction. The larger frequency is proportional to the field in that direction. Okay, it's straight and narrow. So if you have two spins marked next to each other, if you put them like this, this field is going to point up and add to the back magnetic field. So this one is going to rotate a little bit faster. If I put this one down, it subtracts from the back magnetic field. Okay, so this one is going to rotate a little bit slower. So depending if you are up or down, okay, this one is going to behave differently, and similarly for that one. Okay, so you can see this from the Hamiltonian of the system. Remember the Hamiltonian for my system is H, and I think moment I'm B. And then in the B, we have a B0 in the Z direction, which is the big background magnetic field of the magnet, plus some B, which is the radio frequency field. So right now, let's forget about this. And there's also the coupling between the two fields. And what you get is that it looks like omega 1, Z1 plus omega 2, Z2 plus omega 3, J, Z1. And here my notation, I assume that with Daniel, with stabilizers, you know what I mean by this. This is the sigma z tensor 1. This is 1 tensor sigma z2. And this is z1 tensor z2. Everybody on board on this? No? Okay. Your head was moving like this. Okay. So if you look at this, and the evolution, you know, it's goes like this, and you're thinking about what's happening to spin 2 when the first spin 1 is pointing up, so spin number 1. You realize that you don't have to worry about this. You have this term here, which is the Lorentz frequency. But 0 is an eigenstate with eigenvalue 1 of Z1. So the effective thing is that omega 2C, or this second spin C, is omega 2 plus J Z2. So the Lorentz frequency is a little bit higher. And if you have the state one is in 2, then you have the difference. Right? So depending on the first spin being up or down, second spin is going to go a bit faster or a bit slower. And this is a classical way of seeing it, but turns out that in the simple system, it's the same thing. You can, it is sufficient. So it turns out that this is why when I look at this little thing here, I put two little bars for each of the spin, because they are split by the value of J. So you can measure the coupling between the spin being there. So this is how the two qubits talk to each other. You remember in your transistors, classically, you have a wire between transistors, kind of bit one and bit two. Here, we have the electromagnetic field, which have an impact between one qubit to the other. Okay. Now that I told you this, seems reasonable, seems to work. I'm really cheating when I tell you that the interaction is really the dipole-dipole interaction between two of the spins, because the molecules are tumbling incredibly fast. If you take the dipole-dipole interaction and you are there, and you remember the dipole-dipole interaction is proportional to the radius between two spins, it's tumbling very fast, nanoseconds time. And the dipole-dipole interaction is of the order of kilohertz, so millisecond time. You spend as long like this as you are like this, and this cancels. So it's not the dipole-dipole interaction that you see in the liquid state. But what you see is there's an electronic cloud between these two atoms. And the electrons change slight energy, the lowest energy electron on the S state. When it has an overlap between the two nucleus, its energy changes depending if the nuclear spins are pointing in the same direction or positive direction. And this is really the interaction that we're using. So this was an aside, a little bit of physics, but it's the one so that you don't come and sue me. That kind of I've not told you the right story. So with this, you can think about what does the spin does in a pictorial way. If you have a spin which is pointing up, the magnetic field, I'll go back to my old story. First spin is pointing up, the second spin in the rotating frame is going to go anticlockwise. And if the first spin is pointing down, the spin is going to go clockwise, so a little bit slower in the frame, or a bit faster. And in the rotating frame, it looks like it's going backward. Okay? So with this, we have the one qubit gate I mentioned, the two qubit gate. We have our qubits. We know how to measure them. The last thing that I'd like to mention on this is time that noise comes in. And in NMR, there's two types of noise. One is called the relaxation. That is, you put things at random and so they equilibrate at some thermal, towards a thermal state. So this time to kind of flip and come back to equilibrium is called T1. T1 in the molecule that we have is of the order of a few seconds to 30 seconds. There's another error which comes in, is if you take many spins, or if you take one spin, put it in a plane, make it rotate, it doesn't really go exactly to the Larmor frequency. They come a little bit of interaction between maybe some molecule around, or the magnetic field is not exactly constant and all of this. And then you lose the phase information. And this loss of phase information, which is exactly the loss of quantum phase, turns out, is over the order of 1 second. Then the other numbers is what is the time of interaction between those two is 100 hertz, so about 10 milliseconds. So namely, you can do, let's say, 100 gates before things go to hell and you cannot do it anymore. So that gives you an idea of the scales. And the last one that I want to tell you is, the time to do one qubit gate. Like to do a pulse, take the spin to go from that direction to there, is of the order of the difference between the Larmor frequency between two spins. Because if the Larmor frequency is, let's say, the difference is delta, if you want to talk to this one, talk to this one, that'll take you roughly 1/delta. On here, when the atoms have a very different Larmor frequency, like in hydrogen and carbon, the difference is in the field web megahertz. So, instantaneous for practical purposes. But when we go and look at the other molecule that I'll mention a bit, trichloroethylene, where you have two carbons, the difference between two is about a kilohertz. So it's about a millisecond to talk to one, talking together. Now, the neat things in there is that there's a difference of the scale in the problem. Millisecond to talk to one, do the one qubit gate, 10 milliseconds to do the two qubit gates, and about a second to get the decoherence. So all these things kind of become separated. So that's easy to think about it the way that computer scientists think about their problem, that is, you do one qubit gate, and when you do one qubit gate, there's no two beats. two qubit gate that happens, and then you can go into things like this. And you can think on a one qubit gate, there's no decoherence, but if you do many of them, then there will be. So it's really, it's like a textbook problem when you go and look at these small molecules and try to do information processing. Okay. I put some notation here, just I all left my notes. But one thing is my sigma, my parameters is x, y, and z. And then going to my slide, I realized that I had another notation, because NMR people, instead of using the polymatrix sigma x or x, they use something which is x, y, or z, which is half of the sigma y. So if you look at my note, then suddenly you see an I somewhere, then be careful with factors of two.
I hope that's a mistake for sigma y.
Good. I keep this one there exactly to check if people are.
It's been there for 3 years.
I think in that Hamiltonian, I think the main term should be S dot S. Why we can consider it as just S dot 1, S1 dot S2? Why we can consider it just?
Okay, it would be the dipole-dipole attraction between the two. This is what S.
Yeah.
And that's what I mentioned a few minutes ago. The molecules are tumbling incredibly fast with respect to each other. Okay, so that this. So this is proportional to the radius, or the vector, and then R cubed. And if you do integral of this over theta and phi with the right measure, then this goes to zero. Okay. Also, another thing that I'm going to use is I'm going to talk about the density matrix instead of the state in terms of x, y, and z. So is that familiar? So instead of saying the state is cos theta 0 plus 5, 5 theta 1, pointing in that direction here, I think about this as the z, x, and y axis, and the component of this corresponds to what you have in the density matrix. So when I write the density matrix, instead of some state like 0 plus 1, this is equivalent to the density matrix rho of 1 half plus 1 plus. So if you do error correction with the stabilizer formula, you should really get used to this. And then you create this x, y, and z, and do many, many things with them. That happens all the time. Turns out that if you do NMR in the liquid state, it's also the best representation. Because when you do a one qubit gate, it's essentially a rotation of x, y, z to x prime, y prime, z prime, or the coefficient of them. So it's really easy to see what you're doing. And when the interaction is zz, it also changes x. Or if you have a product of polymatrices, it remains a product of all the matrices. So it's easy to see how the system is evolving. Very easy to track down the state. Okay. So what I want to do now is using the gates that I've mentioned to you to make the first sample gate that we're going to use of the Leon doing a control knot. So everybody knows what a control knot is, right?
Yes.
Who doesn't know what a control knot is? No, I prefer the active part, the participation. So you know what a control knot is. So if I want to do a control knot, how do I make this up to my ZZ gate and my one qubit rotation? So the answer is, you do so. Unfortunately, on the NMR machine, you want to do a control knot. You cannot yet, or maybe you could push a button if you do use some some pre-processing somewhere. But really, if you want to write this in terms of gates, which are fundamental on which you read control, you'll have some 1-qubit gate. And the way we're going to write them is if you want to rotate around the y-axis by 90 degrees, you would write something like this. And y90 means, well, there it's on the hydrogen or a second qubit, so it would be minus I pi over 4 y on an alpha double h or for the second qubit, an index like this. And by this, I mean really one tensor this time, right? So if you take that gate, implement this on the state, and kind of rotate that qubit. This thing here is a 2-qubit gate, and by this, I mean I pi over 4, z1 and z2. You remember that I said 90 degrees, but I put a pi over 4 here, and it's because we are dealing with spin half particles with these factors of 2 going around and around doing different things. So remember this. So my claim is, if you do a wire rotation, so if you want to do the control nut, where the control is the carbon, you do a wire rotation on the hydrogen, you do one of these 2-qubit gates by this amount of time. So I should have really put that this is equal to J times the time T. So once you know J, the coupling, you know how long you have to wait. Okay, and I'll show you this in a second, what exactly I mean. As you go, you wait that time, then you do a Z rotation, you do a Y rotation, and then you do an X rotation on that qubit, and this will make a control knot. So how do you go and show this, that this is correct? Or you know what is the representation of these things, you multiply all these matrices, and then you get something which would look like a control knot. You get to the algebra as well as like that. And then there might be some global factors, which factors out, so this is a homework for you. To convince you that this is right, without doing too much work, what I'm going to do is look at the two states which are here, and I'm going to go through these gates with this spectral thing that I mentioned before. So I'm going to use these two states, 0, 0 here, and show you that after all these gates, I got back to 0, 0. If I add 1, 0, I end up 1, 1, and I'll leave you doing 0, 1, 1, 1. So if you follow all these gates, here's what you get. So I'm sure you're convinced by now. And I'm happy you smile and laugh. Because then I would have put somebody in the next video. So we're going to do, on my graph, I have C1 and C2 instead of C and H. So you can remember this. So here's the 0, 0. OK, C1 and C2 are C and H. And then here we have C1, or C being in the 1 position, and the second qubit being in the 0. And what we want to show is that when we end up after the circuit, this one will end up at the same place, but here both will end up. So the first gate is a wire rotation of qubit 2, and Y is this axis here. So there you are. I do a rotation by 90 degrees. Okay? Now I do the 2-qubit gate. So this one is pointing up. So this one is going to go in one direction, and this one is pointing down, so it'll go in the other direction. And when I say a 2-qubit gate by a certain time t, what I want to do is a relative 90 degree difference. So there it goes. Okay, so this is like 2-qubit gate. And now we have a Z rotation. 4-qubit one, but it's already in the Z direction, so nothing happens. A Y direction, right, rotation for second qubit, but it's already in the Y direction, so nothing happens. And then you have to do the last rotation around the Y, the X axis from this point. And if you get, there you are. So now you've done the control knot without doing any equation, just following some directive. So you can see you started with this, and whatever. So then you can go in the other ones and convince yourself that this set of gates is doing the control knot. So you're nearly there. So you've done a little bit of an MR. I haven't done error correction yet, but there you are. Now here's a trick question. When I write here, I told you that we already see access and y-axis, so we don't have to do that. So should I just get rid of these two gates? Or, right, question number two, why did they put them there?
The other two cases?
Superposition.
Good. So if I look at them straight out, right, although they look like it's not doing anything, it brings a phase. As a relative phase that comes in that you would neglect if you just do the state 0, 0. But if you do the state 0, 0 plus 0, 1, then you would get a relative phase which is different between the two. And then this would count when you do temporal lots. So if you drop them, it will work for 0, 0, but not this population. Second tricky question. Now, I've shown you, you know, when people think about universal set of gates, you can do with one qubit, a generic one qubit gate, which I show you on the sphere how you kind of manipulate around. Then I've shown you how to do control knot gates, two qubit gates, again by showing you classical pictures. And I've shown you all of this classically. But these two sets of gates are universal. So what's the problem? Why can I not explain to you the whole of NMR classically, just by looking at one picture like this and following all your pictures are going. You know the answer still.
I'm not even sure if it's the right answer. Mm-hmm. I'm not even sure if it's the right answer. Well, you never consider any superposition, right?
And what would happen if I consider superposition?
Well, then I would guess like phases start coming in and then.
Yeah, but the phase, if I have one qubit, I have a phase, this, like this. This is a phase in the x-y plane. So
you need an entanglement, right?
What?
You need an entanglement?
Yeah, how does entanglement show up from there?
Well, it's unsure.
So why can't I explain all of quantum computation with little diagrams like this?
Because you would need one for each term in the.
Good, exactly this. So if I start with a superposition of 0, 0, and 0, 1, the second spin would be in the x direction. So I would put it as a vector. Okay? But when I go and do the ZZ interaction, I have to put them, separate them, and the control being up or down. And so every time I get to a ZZ gate, then that my diagram would split in two. So I have n ZZ gate, then it will go back two to the n. So I have two to the n, and it'll evolve like this. If I can stay on. So that's what I want to. That doesn't mean that this thing is quantum. It just doesn't mean that we don't know how to explain it with these pictures. Okay, so if you go to the NMR spectrometer, oh, talking about the NMR spectrometer, I forgot to add this one. So you should see what the spectrometer looks like. So this is what the spectrometer looks like. This is the box of electronics, which kind of make the radio frequency pulse. This is the magnet one. So this one is a 700 megahertz. Now, this is the pre amplifier. I don't know why this needs so much attention. It's just one box, which like the video guy. I'm very excited about it. That's Mike Diddy. And here's the actor. Can they make out there for the sample in his hand? It looks like one of those strange. And then he goes with the sample, put it in the middle. And then there's some air jets, which keeps the sample at the top. You go back to the bottom, stop this, and then it goes down straight in the middle of the magnet. It's a small sweet spot where the magnet is very, very homogeneous. And then when you sit down there, once the small sample is there, you sit down and you homogenize the magnetic field even more by a bunch of little coils around. And it's called shimming. And nothing, and we all give him a hard time. He's a specialist of shimming. There's all this, very hard. To give you an idea of scale, this thing does a turn every a billionth of a second. The experiments we do last a second. So it's a billion turn. And if you do a quantum computation, you know that if you are in this direction or this direction, it's 0 plus 1 and 0 plus I1, which is states which are that are orthogonal to each other. Or by pi, you would be orthogonal to each other. And then you would ask, would that come to the link? So after a billion turn, you still have to track where you are by a fraction of a degree, if you want to say that they like an experiment. So it's pretty amazing.
So what did that take in the force in the time? Like, don't go close on this? Or?
You can see between Marie's leg down there, there's the tape. I mean, it's the line for 5 Gauss. And 5 Gauss is a place where your BlackBerry, your credit card starts to get affected. Yeah, exactly. You see, in fact, I want to do this with my BlackBerry. You know that BlackBerry has a little magnet. And if you put it in there, it's how it turns off. If you bring your BlackBerry next to the magnet, it will turn off. But the worrisome point is that you want to turn off without erasing any data that you have. So I have to use somebody else. Okay.
How many facilities are there worldwide that have this kind of equipment?
A liquid state and mass spectrometer, every chemistry department of any decent university. So at the University of Waterloo, we have, a 500, a 600, a 700, a bunch of small ones. Probably half a dozen magnets where we can do some small experiments. If you go to the magnet you saw there was a bigger one, so there I would say probably 30, 40 universities in the world. If you go to a 900 stuff, then you'll probably have 6 or 7 places in the world. You can have the higher the field, more difficult. But in these experiments here, we can say it's off the shelf equipment.
Yeah.
So not yet Walmart, but not that far from there. Okay, so what I want to show, and I have till 5 o'clock, right?
Yes.
So half an hour. What I want to show is give you a rough idea of when you go to the spectrometer, what the hell do you see?
Can I just ask quickly on this question? Because you guys are known for sort of very good control in NMR, so what's the difference then between you guys and other facilities? Your compiler, said that the equipment's on.
So why have other people not control as many qubits as we did? Just because our goal was to control many of them, find the right molecule, have the right set of control method. So it's easy to do an experiment where you have sloppy control. And what we do, you get to have very, very precise control. And not many people sit down and try to get that control.
That's your pulse sequences and some pulse driver, whatever they're called, compiler?
Yeah, compiler method to make pulses more accurate. So for this, I should give you an example of what most spectrometers around the world do, is try to find the typical application for chemists is, I'll give you some vial with something, and you will go and put this in your spectrometer, you'll see a bunch of lines somewhere. Then you have software which says, okay, with these lines there, you have this chemical in this vial. What we do is, and then the second application from the chemist is, once they know certain type of chemical, they can learn the structure of this molecule just by looking how the lines are shaped and how far apart they are from each other. So they can determine the structure. What we do is that we find molecules where we know the structure very well. We have a set of characteristics that we need the structure to have. For example, we want the Larmor frequency to be as large as possible between different qubits, because it's very near. We cannot talk to one without talking to the other. We want to be as far as possible, but we still want to have a strong coupling between the two quantum bits so they can talk to each other on a rather quick time. So we have a series of requirements like this, low requirements. And we all have this up and find a few molecules which have these kind of characteristics.
So it's basically only the software. So the machine itself is not as much as any kind of modifying.
Yeah, a lot of it is the software and techniques to make things more robust. So maybe at the end we can go and talk about this. What I wanted to do today is not go into kind of nitty gritty things of kind of all the tricks that you have to add up and do different things to make things more precise, just to say what kind of error correction thing you want to do. So we can talk a little bit more about that kind of nitty gritty things that we've been doing. Okay. Here again, what we go and see at the spectrometer. So I showed you a few minutes before, if we have a spectrum, we would have two lines. We look at, let's say, the carbon out of the molecule, which has an hydrogen and a carbon. In fact, nobody asked me. There were some other nuclei there which were yellow. They are chlorine. And turns out that they interact incredibly weakly with that carbon. So that's why we neglect them. And that's why we have to look only at the carbon. And this is a carbon 13. Carbon 12 does that in the here spin. So if you look at this, the spectrum of this, there's two lines, and the difference between the two is this coupling that we have between the hydrogen and the carbon. This line is what is given by the current at the frequency when the hydrogen is in the state zero, and this one when the hydrogen is in the state one. Okay? So what we've done here is set up the initial state, so we don't have an equal amount of the state zero and the state one of the hydrogen, but we have only one. We want to do a control knot between those two, where the control is the carbon, and the target is the hydrogen. So if we start here with the hydrogen, the control in the state zero, we do the control rod gate, the one which is between there, nothing is going to happen, and we'll get something which looks like the same peak. And if you look carefully, you see a small difference. So at least it was not exactly the same picture, as you can see. So we've done the same thing. The next one is to do the other gate, where suddenly the hydrogen or the control is in the state one. So you remember that the state one is the state one plus z. Okay, so that's the control. The target is the state one plus z. Oh, sorry. Okay, so this is the control. And you remember I'm writing in terms of density matrix here. So this is the z operator. This is the state one. This is the equivalent. I'm sure they heard that's the state one. If we do the control knot, this is going to change the sign here, going from 0 to 1, so this will become a minus sign. So instead of, so that's the next experiment, we start with this initial state here. This is what we are seeing here. We do the control knot, it'll bring a minus sign here, and the effect of this is looking at the speed, instead of pointing up, it's going to point up. And this is what you do when you go and implement this. What you see in the experiment. Okay? So now I have about half an hour and we'll go and do error correction with this. We have all the ingredients, right? We know how to integrate our qubits, we know how to do control knots. We just need to know what is the noise model. I told you that the noise model is bit flips. So this makes sense to you guys if I talk bit flip or decoherence from the first qubit. So by this, I mean, is the idea of cross operator? Yes. Okay, so the error model at YouTube. I'll write it in one way, and then the noise that I'm thinking of is the decoherence noise, which means the odd diagonal terms are going to shrink by a time t over t2 exponential of this. And we can write this in terms of the sum of two terms. Okay, one of them is nothing happened to our system, plus also something which has GIZ is sigma z, the bit flip on each side. This is the system has not been affected, the system is being affected, and the probability of each is related to the initial picking index. So this is how we discretize the errors in the quantum world and say we have two processes and we have each probability. So this is the noise that we're going to do. And you remember that you have errors which are sigma z is the same thing as having a sigma x error, but it's a different basis. So if you know the error correcting code for sigma x, which is the same as the classical codes, 0 goes to 0, 0, 0, 1 goes to 1, 1, 1, 1, then we change basis, then this would be an error correcting code. So I assume that you know that part. I'm going to write this. So here's what we're doing. We're going to start with a state, alpha 0, alpha 0, alpha 0 plus beta 1, and 0 and 0 for the other qubit. We're then going to do a control knot between the first and second qubit, a control knot between the first and the third qubit, and then we're going to rotate and do an ADMR. But really, it's not the usual ADMR that you are. It's not the computer scientist ADMR. It's a rotation around the y-axis, which does the same thing going to the 0, 1 basis, the plus and minus basis. OK? Here it is. OK? And the signs are slightly different. So why do I do a y rotation instead of an ADMR?
Is it way easier?
Yes. In fact, if I have a single qubit, I cannot do an ADMR. So ADMR is this, right? And it turns out if you look at this, it has determinant minus 1. And all the gates that I do are always kind of deformation from the unit transformation. And I can get something which has determinant 1.
We can get it onto a phase, right?
Yeah.
A little phase.
So you would have to do that. Which is exactly what this thing is doing. So the easy thing is to do the wire rotation instead of doing the other. Okay, so once you know this, so what I'm going to do is it takes the state alpha 0 plus beta 1 and then change it to the state alpha plus 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 beta minus minus. And the reason I put this, and I assume that everybody has seen that code, right? Okay, the phase gives you a probability of having an error on the first qubit, second qubit, and the third qubit. And then you decode, which is doing the encoding completely in reverse. And then you get a state which is alpha 0 plus beta 1, 0, 0, if no error has come in, so the same start state that you started here. And then if you have an error on the first qubit, you get alpha 1 plus beta 0 and 1, 1. Alpha 0 plus beta 1, 0, 1. Alpha 0 plus beta 1, 1, 0. And this is your syndrome. And you see that you don't have to correct for state number 3, 4, and 1. But when you have 1, 1 here, you have to make a bit flip, which is the error correcting gate, which is a doubling gate, which is a control X, and then you would get back up on the open door. Sorry to kind of flip this. Now, what I want to do is, do I want to do this? Yeah, maybe I'll do this. Yeah.
So we see that, like, so if you have four possible errors, like 3 out of 4 times, the error sort of magically corrects itself. There's only like one case where you have to actually apply the error correction, right?
Yeah.
So would you say that even though you're not applying the Toffoli gate at the end, you still are doing your regression?
Well, you have not lost the information. The information is still there. But now you have a correlation between the last 2 qubits and your transform state. Right? And if you go and throw these qubits in the garbage, then you would get something which wrong a quarter of the time. Suppose that all of this happened at the same rate, then you would lose the information a quarter of the time. But if you do that gate, what you see is that this will become alpha 0 plus beta 1, or what we have here, tensor something. And you don't care what it is, this stuff now. So that qubit has preserved its information. Okay?
You got to turn off the direction, right?
Okay. I got what?
The direction you're speaking. You got to turn it off.
Very good. in fact, you can't figure it out. But I didn't explain how. And I'm going to explain maybe around 5. If I don't answer this, I'll come back to you. OK? So what I've written here is the same thing. Instead of writing it, in terms of state, in terms of poly operators. So the state 0 is 1 plus z, and then I have this stupid factor of 2 because I use this. I use this to talk, to give a talk to the NMR people who carry this I and these factors of 2, so that's how I do, not arguing. So we can forget about this factor of 2 and think about z here and z here. And we do a control not, and that's what I was going to show you how to encode this. It's a good exercise in error propagation or manipulation of polymorphic species. So suppose that I have X sensor 1. And then I'm going to a control knot. What do I get at the end of here? There's a very neat way to think about this, which is, here I'm saying that the state is looking like this, but you can think about an error coming in. If you have an error on the state that came here, it's going to flip the 0 to the 1 and the 1 to 0, and the control nut is going to apply at the wrong time and induce an error here when it was not supposed to. So, and this error goes through the control, so you get this. Okay? So x1 goes to xx. Suppose that you have now 1x. What happens to it? So we go like this. What would you get?
One x.
Because this commutes with this control, right? That the happens on that, it goes straight through. So now xx would go to what? In fact, xx turns out to be the product of the two. And because this whole thing is an error, you can multiply that. So you multiply those two. X by x is 1. X by this is x. I should be very careful to keep the index of this 1. 1 and 2. OK? So we have this. The next one I want to do is, what happened to z1? To 1z. This is the really interesting one. So classically, if you do something on the control gate, nothing happens. So this one, my claim is that it goes to zz. When you have a phase error there, it comes, creeps up here, even if it's on the control. So a control knot. So I'm going to go and try to explain this. How does that? Control nut is the same thing as a control z with an NMR, right? And a control z is the same thing that way. Is the same thing as this. Right? In fact, I was not going to.
Okay.
I was not going to do it that way, but maybe you can think about this as well. And this is equal to LMR, 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 control X. Okay. Complete silence. I need some nod of saying, I'm lost, you completely. Good. So now, I was thinking about what's happening when we have a z here. So we have a z here. Z going to LMR turns it into an x. So it's the same thing as having the x there. And now it's a controlled X. So going through this is equivalent of having two X's there. We'll go into the IMR just to be this easy. So without doing too much calculation, we'll find matrices that I hope I've convinced you. But the tricky part to me is to remember that this is equal to that. It's not obvious to you if you look at this. This is the matrix, which is 1, 1, 1, minus 1. Okay, and you can see that this one is completely symmetric of who's the controller and who's the target. So that's why you can fit them. So when you look at the fault tolerance, you'll kind of do a lot of that kind of stuff. So I did all of this so that I can do the encoding. Are you okay with this? So encoding in terms of, suppose that the way I guess, 1 plus z, 1 plus z, this is equal to 1. Take the easy case. Put the z here. Because I've done it before in my notes, and then I won't make too many errors. And then I do the NMR transformation. So these are the two controllers. Then the y90s, which turns this into x11 plus x1 plus x1, x, plus, x, x, x. Which is what we get there on the angle. So I didn't do the factor of 4 here because, again, it's my eye and factors are different for the rest of it. So we've seen how to encode with.
But I'm sure it would not be like IXX your first time. Like your first Z shouldn't be like Z, IZZ. What kind of makes sense that your state has to be symmetric, right?
But it's not because I have Z here, then 1 plus Z, then 1 plus Z. 1 plus Z.
No, but what I'm saying is you're trying to preserve this Z information. Right? And your noise is symmetric.
No, in fact, I'm not trying. Here's what happened. When you look at the decoherence of these terms, which is what's happening here, okay? What you see is that the first term decays with this term, and then here we have three of these XS and YY, so you have to go to the zero. The one with three quarters, you have a decay of this form. And the turns here is going to decay with a different value. And if you add them all together after the decoding, you get something of this form. 9 turns that way in one, but the exponent is different. And then if you look to the leading order key, then the first one appears. Okay. So this is what we did. Go ahead and implement this. And so here is an example of this encoding, decoding. This thing which is slightly different than the circuit that we had before is the qubit, the gate that we do is control that from this one to this one, and this one to this one. So, and the reason is that the molecule, if I thought that's a picture of the molecule. So the molecule is of this form here. So because it's harder to make a control nut between this one and this one, then we kind of set up our error correcting code so that it's the least number of gates. We do over two control nuts. Our X or Y rotation, doesn't matter which one. The coherence, the decoding, which is the inverse of here, and the Teflon gate. And you remember Teflon gate that you can do a Teflon gate if you go remember the paper by Barrico and Cleave and Eschua, if you have a three-qubit gate, control, X rotation in the middle. And it's because of the geometry of the molecule that we kind of go and do. Instead of the control, X, we just do the control on each side. It's slightly easier to implement. And there's a gate from Barrico that you can learn that if you need a control square root of X, control not, control square root of X minus 1, control X, and then control square root of X. And if you go and look at the detail of this, you'll see that this is equivalent of a gate. So you can, the advantage of this is that now you have two-qubit gates instead of a three-qubit gate. And so you can implement it with a bunch of different rotation. And if you go and do all of this in detail and try to optimize, try to look at the specific geometry that you have, it corresponds to a bunch of different gates, one after the other. And there isn't that much I can tell you except of go and work it out. And you'll see that it's going to have it. So this gate here is equivalent of this error correction here. And because we have the decoding part, this part here will go and look at that part here. Okay. And because sometimes we get gates which kind of either cancel each other or that, then you kind of optimize a little bit this circuit here. Okay. Cedric, to answer your question, there's a little gate here, Y180, and it answers your question, but I won't give the total answer, but I'll just come back in a few minutes when I'm done to explain to you how this works. So once you've done this, you can go take some quantum information or some state, send it to your encoding, let the noise decay. So here we make the assumption that the encoding would be perfect. You leave this for a certain amount of time, characterized by T, that your decoding can come in, and then you decode, and then you error correct. So this is the curve that you get. If you don't do the error correction, so it decays exponentially. And if you do error correction, then it kind of flattens up at all day. And why does it flatten up? If I go back here, you remember that the first order term is like t squared. There's not anymore the leading terms in t. So, or in the quantum error correcting terms, is the first qubit error, the single qubit errors have been corrected. So you get something which is flattened, and then it starts. Okay. So the time where you regain something by a correction would be this term here. So the whole demonstration of error correction here was to demonstrate that this thing was a bit flat. And what you would have expected.
What molecule?
What?
What molecule?
It's trichloroethylene. So again, three chlorines, which don't interact very much. You can again, hydrogen, carbon. So the graph here is if we induce error by hand, we just encode, make an error on, okay, here is no error and decode. Okay, so when you don't do error, so we decode without doing the error correction, that means we do a little bit less gate, so it's a little bit higher. When we do the error correction, there's a few errors in the gate that we do, so it's a bit lower. But as soon as there's an error either on this one, a phase error either on this, this one or this one, then the fidelity is very different. One thing that you can see here is that it's a little bit lower when you do the error correction, and it doesn't start at 1.00, the fidelity, and it's because the encoding and decoding is not perfect. So we need 20% of fidelity. The last thing I want to mention on this page is here I wrote fidelity. And what do we mean by this? Is what is the criteria that we want to use to decide if the process has been good or bad? And what we've calculated is what is called the entanglement fidelity. So the idea is, suppose that we have a fictitious system here. We have our system with the quantum information, and this fictitious system can be coupled. And then there's a process here with the environment. We can leave you with some errors. And we go and measure what is the state of Q prime. So what we're thinking of is, suppose that, and the error affects only the system here. So suppose that you would make a state here, which will be like an n-tiple state, 0, 1, minus 1, 0. The noise that comes in affects only the first system. And what we want to do is measure what is the overlap with that state at the end. So the stability of entanglement is equal to 0, 1, minus 1, 0. And I'll write this as psi of f and s, a I psi. AI dagger, where these are my famous cross operator inside. So it's how much you can think about it, it's how much of this chemical state is preserved going through that noise. So it's a measure of how much kind of quantum information has been preserved while we go through the noise. And it turns out that this fidelity of entanglement doesn't depend on that system at all. You can reduce it and show it that this is equivalent to the sum over I of trace of AI trace of AI dagger, where this is the noise which is affecting your quantum system. So another way in the NMR language of calculating this fidelity of entanglement is to send four initial states. One, the unit matrix, the matrix X, the matrix Y, the matrix Z. And looking at how much of one, how much of X, how much of Y, how much of Z, one after the other, is left at the end. So you do four experiments. You know how much of one is left, how much of X is left. This is going to be transformed to something, and you look at how much of X is left at the end, how much of Y, how much is. So if you think about the generic density matrix, these correspond also to thinking about the four elements of your density matrix and taking an average of them. So you can think about that measure there. Big.
Is it different if you have only one encoding and one decoding, or do you use it as much?
It's the same decoding for all initial state. So we prepare a different state here. We go through all of this, and here we measure how much of X is left.
No, I mean, what X axis is the bandwidth between encoding and decoding? Or is it the number of.
You mean the time axis here?
So one experiment, you do only one encoding and one decoding, or do you iterate?
Okay. We wait for a time t here. We do four experiments. One with this initial state, this initial state, this initial state.
No, I'm not asking about what you're talking about. I'm just asking about the experiment in general. So you take this graph.
To get this graph,
okay, you did four
at every dot here corresponds to four experiments?
Yeah, one of those four experiments. In one of those four experiments, you encode with decode?
Yeah.
Or is it iterations of encoding?
No, it's.
Well, not really, I mean.
It is encode?
You could correct things several times.
In fact, you can't. You cannot correct several times. And why is that? Because. Okay, get up. Ah, so when you arrive at the end here, you're not in the state 0, 0, 0, which is the same as that you started here, but you now have a superposition of 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, and 1, 0. So you have a mixture of these initial states, and if you try to re-encode with this, you'll induce the error back in the quantum.
You can finish it.
With this system, liquid state NMR, you cannot reinitialize. So you can do only one round of error correction. But if you want to reinitialize, you can go in other technologies, liquid solid state NMR. That's what we're trying to do right now.
And on the same graph, what would occur if you did no encoding?
It would look like something like this. It's what?
You start at one.
Yeah, you would start at one. If you don't do any encoding, no decoding, nothing, you would start at one and you would decay. And the decay time depends on these three, it's slightly different for this graph.
And you get actually lower than the green curve?
I would have to remember exactly what's the decay time for those, but at length you would arrive here. The hydrogen decays very slowly, so it might just kind of barely touch this one. Yep.
The dashed curve and walls?
The dashed curve and the fold curves are models with different assumptions of the model. One of them is correlation between the errors and correlation between the error. Okay. So another set of experiments that we've done is to go from the 1-qubit error correcting code, which corrects for phase only, or to another code which corrects for a generic 1-qubit gate. And I'm going to just finish and flashing this in front of you. This is the 5-bit code. And have you seen the 5-bit code yet? Okay. So it's a 5-bit code with a stabilizer, which is probably slightly different than the one that you have, but equivalent to it. It's slightly different because with the molecule that we have and the gate that we have, it was slightly easier to implement this one than another one. So that's correct. You remember when we were encoding with two control knots of the 3-qubit case, two control knots and three LMR gates or wire rotation 90. Now the encoding corresponds to have all of these gates together. The decoding is the same thing as this, but in reverse. And then the equivalent of a Toffoli gate corresponding to all this mess. So when we do the experiments, we encode. In the case here, we did not use the natural errors. We just induced an error on each of the qubit, either an X, a Y, or a Z error. So we did this. And then we decoded on this way. And then we implemented the scheme to correct for Z errors. And then after that, if there's no Z error, nothing is going to happen there. If there's an X error, then it'll be caught here, or Y error is going to be caught up here. So you can see that the process, the recovery operator, correct the error once you know that one has happened, is much, much longer, and then it became a lot harder to make this happen. And here is a little plot, which tells us of what happened if there's zero error, and for each of these peaks, that corresponds to one part error that comes in. Remember that we have 5 qubits, we have x, y, z, that makes 15, plus a zero error case. And if you count here, you should see the 16 possibly coming from here. And here was the fidelity for each of these cases. And on average, we had about 75% fidelity left.
In the NMR system naturally, what's the relative likelihood of the three different Pauli errors?
Very roughly speaking, X errors are of the order of 10 seconds, and Z errors of the order of 1 second. Okay, I was going to finish there. I was going to mention one more thing about some error correction for subsystems. So there's different types of codes. Something called decoherence free subsystem and decoherence free subspace and decoherence free subsystems. And we did some experiments in that direction too, but I'm running out of time. So I'm going to finish by answering your question on how do we turn off the coupling. And how do we do this is the following thing. So we have a time t, and we have 2 qubits let's say, which are coupled with each other. And then at the end, it goes like pi j over 2, z1, z2, and times z times t. And we want to turn off this coupling for this time t here. So what we do is, halfway through, we do a rotation, which is an x180. And at the end, we do another x180. So the effect of this is multiplying this by time over 2. And the x180 on the second qubit is just an x. I think there's a minus sign there. Jt over 2, z1, z2. And then we do another x there. So if we expand this, you have cos pi over 2 jt unit minus pi sine pi j over 2 t z1, z2 multiplied by x1, sorry, by x2, multiplied by x2. Okay? You have to tell me if you understand that or not, because I'll go slower. So if you multiply these two things here, and then there's this term here, and up there, and I'm going to write it. When you multiply these two things here, you get 1. And when you multiply these two things here, you have a term which looks like x2, z1, z2, x2, which is equal to minus z1 and z2. Okay? So if you take this, you change the sign here, it's like putting up here, but with a plus sign. So this equal to e to the plus pi, pi over 2, j, 2, 1, z2. And if you add those two things, they cancel. OK? So this is how you do it. You flip one of the spin in the other direction halfway through. Do you remember when we add the you can now understand this in a pictorial way. If halfway through I flip the two spins, the one which were going faster now is going to go backward, and the one which was going backward was going to go in change direction. So if you do it exactly in the middle, these two things are canceling. And this thing is called refocusing. You just use this. Now there's a neat question that you could ask, and the next one is, so now I've done it for one spin. Now if you have two, it's a little bit more complicated. Okay? So now if I have, here I have two spins, so suppose you have three. And I want to average the zero. So one way of doing this is that you do this one here. Okay, and you'll do some at the end, which I won't neglect. And you can also do one and a half here. And you'll see that all this can be added up the right way. Because if you would do this one exactly in the middle, it would not cancel the both of them. So you have to do it at the right place. But if you have another one, then you would have to do it here, here, and here. And if I keep on doing like this, it will go exponentially. So is there a smarter way to do it?
Yes. I don't remember it.
Is what?
I don't know.
Very good. So instead of thinking about it that way, think about generalization of the NMR matrix, where the first row is always 1, and after that, the next row is, it's a matrix which is made of plus and minuses, except for the first row, which adds up all the pluses. All the other ones are plus and minuses, which add up to zero. And they're all orthogonal to each other when you multiply them. So the first, I should have written this as plus, 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 plus. And this one is plus, 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 minus, 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 minus. The next one is minus, minus, plus, plus, minus, minus, plus, plus. So you can see that continuing like this, they all cancel. So you go and look at the nearest LMR matrix. And every time you see a plus switching to a minus, you're going to put a false. And with this, they all add up the right way because all things add up to zero. And they all also orthogonal to each other, and you have it.
And you can get as only 2 1 which is
here. Yeah. Okay. Any more questions? No. Break time. Dropper will be your turn, so.
So are we going to have a break? Or shall we just continue?
5 minutes to get a coffee.